Welcome to episode 33 of the Fredcast for the week of September the 11th, 2006. My name is David, and I'm a Fred. On this week's episode of the Fredcast, race results from the Tour of Spain, more doping news, a story on how cyclists may actually hurt the environment, a well-known retailer is put out of business by a wildfire, and more. Following the news, listener comments on overhydration and doping, plus a shout-out and an upcoming ride. So sit back, relax, and if you're riding, hammer just a little bit harder, because here comes the Fredcast. Hey, welcome back to another episode of the Fredcast. And by the way, have I mentioned how much I hate business travel? All right, I'm sitting here in another hotel, so hopefully you'll be able to hear me and not the trucks outside. And again, I have to apologize for being a little late, but that's just the way it goes. I am very sorry about that. Well, let's get on with the news. And of course, first topping the news is the Vuelta, because I don't want to get to doping just yet. Anyway, we're in the final week of this year's Vuelta a España, or the Tour of Spain, and the general classification is still extremely tight, especially for the two top spots. When we last met, Alejandro Valverde was leading up the race after stage 11. Now, stage 12 took place last Thursday, and it was won by Italy's Luca Paolini after a 170-kilometer stage, and it was Paolini's first ever stage win in one of the Grand Tours. In fact, he was quoted at the end of the stage as having said that it was a huge emotional boost for him to win a stage in the Vuelta, especially so close to the upcoming World Championships, which, by the way, will take place in Austria next week, September 19th through the 24th, and I have put a link into the show notes. At the end of the stage, Valverde was still in the overall lead, 27 seconds ahead of second place Andrei Kazechkin. Friday saw a 180-kilometer stage 13 victory by Spain's Samuel Sanchez from the Euskaltel team, who won the stage by attacking on a difficult descent a mere 8 kilometers from the finish line, with Norway's Tor Husovt and race leader Alejandro Valverde hot on his heels. Saturday, well, that was another individual time trial, and it was there's still one more to go, and it was one which could have done a great deal of damage to Valverde's lead, but Valverde really honored his leader's jersey by turning in an extremely respectable fourth-place finish in the stage, coming in with a time just 13 seconds slower than stage winner David Miller of Great Britain. This is Miller's first major win since returning to cycling after a two-year doping suspension. After the race, he was quoted as having said, "This victory proves that it's possible to race and win at the highest level in cycling without using banned drugs. I lost everything when I got banned, but now I'm back, and it's fantastic." That's a pretty good comment, I think. Stage 15 on Sunday was a mostly downhill. Obviously, there were a few uphills in there, but they weren't very big, pretty much rolling, but mainly it was a downhill event, 182 kilometers, and as a result, the peloton was really able to stay together fairly well and end the day on a mass sprint to the finish line. When the dust settled, it was Robert Forster of Gerolsteiner who took the victory, with Stuart O'Grady and Danilo Napolitano in second and third, respectively. Valverde finished in 36th overall, but it really didn't do any damage to his lead or to the top standings in the race. Monday was the final rest day of this year's Vuelta, and the peloton returned to racing on Tuesday. Now, in the interim, Alessandro Petacchi had to pull out of the race after a post-race, well, let's call it a tantrum, and this was on Sunday, when he punched his team bus. You heard that right. He punched his team bus, and he broke a bone in his hand. Apparently, Petacchi was just a bit upset at not having won Stage 15, but I'm not quite sure what his bus had to do with the loss. Now, here's a note to future professional cyclists, or to all cyclists, period. When you pick a fight with a bus, you will always lose. So, thank you to Alessandro Petacchi for providing us with an illustration of that very important cycling lesson. Tuesday, Stage 16 was one of the tougher days of this year's Vuelta, with two first category climbs and a very difficult summit finish. The stage victory went to Spaniard Igor Anton of the Euskaltel team, but race leader Alejandro Valverde was close behind in second place, just 23 seconds behind. And the third place finish went to Alexander Vinokourov. Now, with Vino's third place finish in the stage, he moved up to second place in the overall standings, 1 minute and 42 seconds behind Valverde, with Carlos Sastre still in third place. And he's even with Vinokourov after stage 16 at 1 minute and 42 seconds behind. And that brings us to today's stage 17 and a change in the overall leadership of the Vuelta. That's because Vinokourov took second place in the 167-kilometer stage, finishing at the same time as stage winner Tom Danielson. With the bonuses for this placing, and even with Valverde having finished in eighth place in today's stage, Vino now leads the race 9 seconds over Valverde, with Sastre 1 minute and 51 seconds back. This sets the stage for a very exciting last few days of racing in this year's Vuelta. There are now only 4 stages left, including the final day of racing Sunday in Madrid and an individual time trial on Saturday. Now, the general classification is extremely tight, and it looks like Valverde and Vinokourov are going to take this one right down to the wire. So I'm going to be back next week with the final results. Stay tuned. Okay, yawning aside, I do have to get to this doping news because there is quite a bit this week, and I'm going to make it quick because, like you, I'm tired of all of this doping stuff. But there was a very hot story to hit the news wires this week, and I'm sure that hearing it on the Fredcast is not the first place you've heard it because it's been all over the newspapers and all over television and all over radio. And what it is that Frankie Andreu and another of Lance's teammate from the Tour de France in 1999 have admitted to using EPO several times during the race in their support of Lance and his victory that year. So let's now go back and count the number of Lance teammates who have now either admitted or been convicted of having doped. We've got Tyler Hamilton, Roberto Heras, Frankie Andreu, this unnamed but other Lance teammate listed in the New York Times article, which I've linked in the show notes. It has certainly called into question a lot of the faith that people have had in Lance's victory. And not necessarily are people saying that they're doubting whether or not Lance doped because, well, we all know that story. We've talked about it here enough on the Fredcast. But even if Lance didn't, and even if he raced clean, if it's true that his teammates were doping, then he was gaining an advantage as a result of the doping that they were doing. And so even if Lance is 100% clean, it's very difficult now to say that his victories themselves were clean because his domestiques, his support riders, were, at least by their own admission, doping, and so he was gaining as a result. So this is a huge deal. Of course, Lance has come out and he's vehemently denied that any of this occurred, certainly that he had knowledge of any of it. And you know that Frankie and Lance have been feuding over the last couple of months, and that's been very well publicized, including here on the Fredcast. So it's, again, when it comes to doping, I keep having to say it, it's tragic. It is a stain on the sport. And this was a very big story that came out this week. And another big story that came out this week when it came to doping, and this one having to do with who else but Floyd Landis. And in this case, Floyd Landis and his attorneys have asked the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency to throw out the positive doping test that everybody's talking about, that we've talked about enough here on the Fredcast. And they're doing that because they're citing what they're calling gross errors on the part of the French lab that performed the test. And they did this after they received hundreds of pages of details about the test procedures that were carried out at this French lab. Now, among the reasons that Floyd and his attorneys want to see these test results thrown out, his lawyers contend that there were some inconsistent levels on the A samples. Apparently what they do is they separate the A sample and they test it several times, and there were gross inconsistencies in the actual results that were found. Also, some of the sample code numbers on the A sample don't match numbers that belong to Landis. And finally, on the B sample, when they looked at the code number that was assigned to it, it was not a sample number that was assigned to Floyd. And that may point to possible chain of custody issues and other issues, which may completely invalidate the entire testing procedure. So they're going to review this. They'll review the brief. You know, this is just another legal argument. We knew that there were going to be a lot of legal arguments that were going to come up. So we'll see how this one turns out. But it's interesting because these are certainly allegations that we've heard about this French lab in the past. And other writers have tried to make these same accusations about this lab. And you may also remember that Floyd was saying that he felt that perhaps this lab was to blame, and he was saying that weeks ago. And remember, he was talking about that. He said that there may be some sort of an agenda here, or perhaps some sort of a French conspiracy, which even some of you Fredcast listeners have mentioned. I don't necessarily buy into any of that, but I do believe that a lab that is handling such critical items that can ruin the career of an athlete should definitely follow established procedures, and that those procedures should be ironclad. Just as Floyd is being investigated, I think it's also time for the UCI and for WADA and for the organizers of the Tour de France to do a thorough investigation of this lab, find out whether or not they are following established procedures, whether their chain of custody is correct. And if not, I think perhaps that it's time that they find another lab to use and let this lab work out its problems, but not at the expense of professional cycling. Now, along these same lines, there was another story this week that came out that said that overall in the Tour de France, 13 riders actually test positive for the use of drugs, but only Floyd Landis tested positive without a medical excuse for banned substances. So here's the way this works. Let's say that you are a professional rider and you have some medical ailment, and your doctor writes a prescription that says, Johnny Professional Rider is allowed to ride in the Tour de France using this banned substance because he has a, and then fill in the blank, whatever the malady is. And so then, as long as you come with your doctor's note, you are allowed to ride with these banned substances in your body, no matter what they are. Now, of course, this calls into question a couple of things. I mean, let's look at the Operacion Puerto scandal. Who's at the center of this? It's a doctor, Eufemiano Fuentes. So who's to say that you can't find a doctor to fake a note so that you can take these banned substances and increase your performance in the event? And don't you think that this is something that WADA and the UCI need to look at? You know, I read an article and it said that the UCI said that all of its certifications were followed by WADA's standards. But Pat McQuaid told the AP that it's possible some riders could be manipulating the rules to hide doping. Gee, you think? It sort of reminds me of the show that was on in the 70s here in the United States called Welcome Back, Cotter. And it was about a group of kids in sort of a remedial classroom. And they're all a bunch of guys who screwed around a lot. And one of them, his name was Epstein. And he used to come in all the time with a note from his mother. And it would say, you know, Juan can't do his homework today because he hurt his hand, or Juan can't go to school today because he's ill. And it was never signed Mrs. Epstein or with the lady's real name. No, it was signed in Juan's own handwriting, Epstein's mother. That was the signature. Well, it's sort of the same thing. You know, Joe Professional Cyclist is allowed to take synthetic testosterone because he has some medical malady, signed Joe Professional Cyclist Doctor. Gee, you think people are actually manipulating the rules to hide doping? And finally, on the doping front tonight, at least for the news, comes news from Switzerland that Jan Ulrich's home and his manager's home, as well as the headquarters for his team, or his former team, T-Mobile, were searched by authorities in their ongoing investigation of Jan Ulrich and his possible connection to Eufemiano Fuentes and the Operacion Puerto scandal. Now, I mean, this one was sort of a low blow because they actually searched Jan's home while he was off on his honeymoon. I don't know. I don't think that's very cool. Nevertheless, nobody is saying whether or not they found anything or whether or not they found any connection between Jan and Fuentes or Puerto in any of the locations that they search, and I'm sure if they did, we'll be hearing about it soon. I don't know. I mean, I'm all for investigating doping, but it just seems to me, you know, don't bug the guy when he's on his honeymoon. That's just my opinion. Okay, one more doping story, but I think that this one is a real important one to read. And you may recall that recently I told you that U.S. sprinter Marion Jones tested positive for the use of EPO and that she was going to be awaiting the results of her B sample. Well, again, buried in the back pages of the sports section, we find out last week that Marion Jones' B sample came back negative. That's right, negative. So as a result, remember we all talked about this in the Floyd Landis case, if the B sample came back negative, then that was going to be conclusive proof that Floyd wasn't guilty. And it should be conclusive proof that Jones is not guilty. But here's the problem. Dick Pound, the chairman of WADA, has now come out and said that he wants an investigation of the B sample. Pound wants to know why it is that there were inconsistencies between the A sample and the B sample, and he said that he found the inconsistent test, quote, disturbing. He said, quote, we're going to see how it happened, learn from it, and try to make sure it doesn't happen in the future. The worry we have is that someone is misinterpreting things or doing things wrong. I suppose if our experts look at it and say on the basis of what we have seen there is no question it should have been positive, we have an opportunity to put that into play. So this actually begs the question. If your rules are going to be that a contradictory B sample is conclusive evidence, why even have those rules if you're not going to believe the results of the B sample to begin with? And if you're going to question the results of every B sample, then, Mr. Pound, why aren't you questioning the results of Floyd Landis's B sample? Couldn't it be that in both his A and his B samples, people are, to use your words, misinterpreting the results? Now, again, I'm not trying to make excuses for Floyd. Please don't take this out of context. All I'm saying is the rule is that a B sample is conclusive evidence that contradicts the A sample. Then why is it that in this case, Mr. Pound wants to launch an investigation? This smells. Well, from one hot button issue to the next, let's go from doping and talk about the environment. There was a very interesting article that appeared in the New York Times recently that quoted a Dr. Carl T. Ulrich, who is a professor at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania, and he's put forth a new paper, a scholarly paper, about the effect on the environment of cyclists. Okay, so let's back up one second. You, of course, are thinking, the effect on the environment of cyclists, I don't get it. Cyclists ride their bikes instead of driving gas-guzzling cars. How is it that we have an effect negatively on the environment? Well, his conclusions are that cyclists live longer because we're more physically fit, at least we hope we are. And as a result, we're going to use more energy in our lifetimes than people who are not cyclists, that we're going to eat more food because of our increased activity as well as our increased longevity, and therefore that's going to harm the environment. And he's got some other conclusions in there as well. Now, I've put a link in the show notes to Ulrich's website. And I've also put a link in the show notes to a TerraPass.com website that really blows holes in Ulrich's arguments. But I'm going to leave it to you to read these. I wanted to point it out to you because I think it's interesting, and it certainly is contradictory to a lot of the things that we've all assumed. And, you know, I think it's at least an interesting thing to explore. While I think that he's probably wrong, I think it's something that we should all look at. Now, here's a story that I did not find on the internet and that I did, well, I mean, it's on the internet, but I didn't find it my usual news sources, and I didn't see it in any of the regional or national newspapers. And this one came to me from listener Sean, and it really is sort of sad. Many of you have probably ordered from the internet website Branford Bikes before, and Branford Bikes was located in Emigrant, Montana. And I'm going to read directly to you from their website. It says, a massive wildfire engulfed our community in Emigrant, Montana on Sunday, July 30th. Our shop was completely destroyed. We tried to save our inventory by placing it in an on-site bomb shelter. the intense inferno melted glass and aluminum and turned concrete to powder. Our retail store, warehouse, our home, and the homes of several neighbors were little more than piles of white ash and twisted metal on a black and barren landscape. Fortunately, no lives were lost. On Monday morning, we visited our home with an official escort and saw how severe the fire was. We came back on Wednesday and opened the smoldering bomb shelter. A small fire was still burning inside. All that was left of our inventory was a hot pile of white ash and scorched metal. We decided not to try to rebuild. Branford Bike is now closed forever. We will leave the website up for a few months but cannot accept orders. All orders placed but not filled will be canceled. You may still return items to us and we will credit your card. Our phones no longer work, so please contact us by email with questions or comments. Thank you for your support for the past 30 years. Your support allowed our business to grow and move to the beautiful state of Montana. We love living here and will eventually build a new home in the mountains. And that was signed Tim and the crew at Branford Bike. So, Tim, to you and everybody who worked for you, our deepest condolences for what you've gone through and our greatest thanks for the 30 years of serving the cycling community. And I know I speak for listener Sean and for myself and for many of you, Branford Bikes will very much be missed. Well, I don't normally talk about celebrities and actors and things like that on the Fredcast, but I do have a story about a celebrity who is also a cyclist who's now recovering from a crash. Read recently on the internet that actor David James Elliott, who you may remember played the character Harm on the CBS TV series JAG, basically spent the last week or so recovering from what sounds like it was a pretty bad fall on his bike while he was riding in Los Angeles last week. What I didn't know about Elliot, because I've certainly seen him on TV, is that he's a triathlete and, of course, therefore also a cyclist. He's even competed in an Ironman. He did the Ironman last year in Hawaii. And apparently he was riding in LA. He took a spill, as many of us have done, and it sounds like it was a pretty bad one because it required stitches on his ear and his forehead. And thankfully, his wife came and picked him up and took him to the emergency room. But he was able to return to work on the set of his new drama, Close to Home, last Tuesday. So our best wishes to David James Elliott for a fast recovery. And, of course, we hope that we'll see him back out there on the road in L.A. sometime soon. So in the story of David James Elliott, his wife was able to come pick him up and take him to the emergency room. But what happens to cyclists whose wives or husbands or significant others or parents aren't able to come pick them up after they've crashed or been hit by a car or something? Well, normally you would wait by the side of the road for the ambulance to come to pick you up and then they would safely carry you to the hospital. Not so for a cyclist in Anderson, South Carolina, because this cyclist was first hit by a Nissan, and while waiting in the road for an ambulance, the cyclist was hit a second time by a car whose driver stopped for a moment and then fled the scene. So it was a hit and run. Now, the cyclist, whose name has not been released, is in serious condition at Anderson Area Medical Center in Anderson, South Carolina. Apparently, he wasn't wearing a helmet, and his bike didn't have proper lighting. The driver of the second car actually did turn herself in to investigators after, as I said, leaving the scene. And that driver has been charged with leaving the scene of an accident. And we will see what happens. But, you know, sometimes it just seems like it's open season on cyclists out there. I think I've told you before, and I know I mentioned this on the Spokesman podcast, our roundtable podcast that we do every 2 weeks. I go through hundreds, sometimes thousands of news stories preparing the Fredcast every week. And of those, I would say probably 70% deal with cyclists being hit by cars. So please, everyone, I know I say this all the time and I get emails from you saying I sound like your grandmother, but please be careful out there. It is very dangerous for cyclists. Sometimes it is open season on us. So please be careful. And hopefully the drivers will be careful around us as well. And now, speaking of whether or not it's safe to be out there on the road. There is now new research, and this is unbelievable to me, but new research that shows that you may actually be in more danger if you wear a helmet when you ride. Now, I've said a million times that I think that helmets are very important and that I only wear mine, oh, pretty much all the time when I'm on my bike. But a researcher, traffic psychologist Dr. Ian Walker in the UK, used an ultrasonic distance sensor to record data from more than 2,500 overtaking motorists in the UK. And what did he find? He found that drivers get more than 8 centimeters closer to cyclists who wear helmets than they do to people who have nothing on their head at all, or at least no helmet. I mean, they could have a hat on or something, but that they get closer to those who wear helmets. And he's speculating that the reason that they do this is because, quote, drivers think he knows what he's doing. He won't do anything surprising. But that's really quite a dangerous thought, particularly as so many cycling novices are told to wear helmets. And of course, that's true. Think of kids. Here in the United States, most states say that children under the age of 18 have to wear a helmet. Does that necessarily mean that my 10-year-old is a skilled cyclist and that you should get within, you know, 8 centimeters of her, or that you should get 8 centimeters closer? I don't think so. Now, Dr. Walker's research is going to be published in the journal Accident Analysis and Prevention. And interestingly, he was struck twice while he was performing his experiments. He also found, and this is probably the most troubling thing, is that buses and trucks were the worst offenders. The average car gave cyclists 1.33 meters of room, but the average truck got 19 centimeters closer, and the average bus 23 centimeters closer. Then he did something really interesting, and I know all of you out there is going to claim that this was sexist, but I think that it was a really good experiment. He put a wig on, a long wig, and he wanted to see if there was any difference between the way cars treated male cyclists and female cyclists. And what do you think he found? He found that when vehicles were overtaking a female cyclist, they gave an average of 14 centimeters more space when he was wearing the wig. So, what's the lesson to be learned here? Is the lesson, don't wear a helmet when you ride because then the cars are going to stay farther away from you? Or is it, wear a helmet and wear a wig? Well, I'll leave that up to you. And if that bit of news wasn't enough to make you want to stop riding your bike and get off the road, here's another one. Cyclists in Britain could be fined up to £2,500 under a new law being proposed by the Labour Party if they're caught riding without a bell on their handlebars. Now, apparently, and I'm going to have to talk to Carlton Reed about this when we do the spokesman this weekend, but apparently, every bike in Britain is sold with a bell, but there's no regulation that says that that bell has to stay on your handlebars unless this regulation goes into effect. So what's the point here? One of the things that they teach you in law school is you have to figure out what the public policy reasoning is behind every regulation or every law that comes out. So what's the public policy here? Well, apparently they're trying to protect pedestrians from cyclists. And so there's a lot of comment going on in Britain about this. One liberal Democrat said, quote, at a time when our country's transport infrastructure and especially our airports are creaking, you would have thought the Department for Transport would have better things to do with their time. To call this part of the nanny state would be an insult to nannies. Meanwhile, Tory MP Robert Goodwill said, if you're riding a bike, you can shout and that often has more effect. If I see a pedestrian meandering around in the road, I shout, good morning, quite loudly. That seems to do the trick, and it is more friendly. If you ring your bell, people take it as an affront. If I was drawing up a list of things I would like to change about transport in Britain, I think cycle bells would be about 110th on the list. So this is something that is going to be debated, of course, and I can't wait to hear Carlton's take on this weekend. But if I see a pedestrian, I generally yell a very loud, yo! And every single time I yell that, the pedestrian stops in his tracks, turns around and looks in my direction. And then it's at that point, if I'm going to pass them, that I say, hey, I was just trying to warn you. I didn't want to have any problems. And it's a very friendly way to handle the situation. I don't see any reason why they can't do the exact same thing in Britain. And at the sound of the bell, that's going to do it for this week's edition of the news on the Fredcast Cycling Podcast. Well, you'll recall last week that we talked a little bit about overhydration and a listener's comment about that. Well, we got a great comment this week from a Fredcast listener and doctor and future podcaster who wanted to share with you his comments about overhydration. So here is listener Lowell.
David, hi. I'm an anesthesiologist here in Chicago, and I guess to some extent I'm a Fred. But be that as it may, I want to make a comment as to someone else's comment about overhydration. And I think some of the responses or what was said was a little bit misleading. One problem with overhydration is really just too much water, not drinking things with electrolytes and not matching the loss of electrolytes. So I don't want people to get the idea that they shouldn't drink so much when they ride. They should, and I have almost never seen what your listener was talking about. On the contrary, I've seen people get dizzy, weak, fall down, etc., both riding their bike and in the upcoming Chicago Marathon, which is in a few weeks right outside my door here, from drinking too much water and not drinking a mixture of things with electrolytes. So what you said is generally true. You need to drink, you need to pee, and if your urine's getting too light, if your urine is very dark, it's usually a sign that you're concentrated. And that is absolutely true. And I don't want someone to get the idea that they should stop drinking so much when they ride. Actually, there's more of a problem with people not drinking enough when they ride. The only problem with drinking a lot is if it's all water. And I want to emphasize that. Thank you very much.
So thanks to listener Lowell for sending in that comment. And he also sent me a great picture of himself and his titanium bike and his four-year-old son. It's a great picture. I'm going to try to figure out a way to put that on the website so you guys can see it. Appreciate the comment, Lowell, and I think that the bottom line of it is this. Overhydration is, of course, a possible danger. But the most important thing is that if you need to drink something beyond just plain water. My drink of choice is Cytomax. I've also been drinking a lot of glucose, and there's a lot of other great energy and electrolyte drinks out there that are helping replace the nutrients that your body is losing. And Lowell's comment is simply, don't drink just water. This is where you can really get into danger. So keep that in mind. Find a drink that you like and make sure that that's what you're putting in your water bottles or your Camelback so that you are not only replacing your fluids, but that you are also replacing the nutrients and the electrolytes that you're losing as you're out there cycling. So thanks again, Lowell. Appreciate that very much. And I know that you're going to be working on a podcast, and I wish you a lot of luck with that as well. Okay, on another hot topic here on the Fredcast, I have another comment from a listener about doping, and I know we're all getting just a little bit tired of it, but I think that listener Sean has a really interesting perspective, and I wanted to read to you his email, and it says, I see bicycle road racing as NASCAR, and little more. One difference being that in the bicycle world, we can all buy the same machines and use them on the roads. Those cyclists who are professional have little or nothing to do with my sport of cycling. I can admire what they do, but they're not my heroes. They may do amazing things or have great days and amazing crashes too. Like a pro golfer making a hole in one. It's great, even awesome, but it's bound to happen. I do not think they should be allowed to dope at will, as some people suggest. They should be punished to the fullest extent possible. There should be some sense of honor all of us who ride owe it to cycling. One example I've heard is the golfer who calls himself in violation of the rules. They owe it to golf to keep it honest. I don't think the doping is necessary, as so many professionals say, and perhaps even believe. I'm a much bigger fan of the bicycle. It's amazing. That's why I ride, because of the bike. I have a custom-made Italian steel frame, pure beauty, poetry incarnate, and it bears the name Fausto Coppi. The people who ride them are all still just people. The sport we see on TV and read about should be clean and honest. Of course, it seems it's not. I dislike the fact that because I ride, I'm automatically associated with the professional that the non-cyclist hears about once a year during the Tour de France. It becomes fodder for the local news sportscaster, and snickers ensue. Then a, quote, real sport like running gets slapped by doping. It's everywhere, apparently. My sport, the one that I participate in, cycling, has very little to do with those paid professionals. My sport belongs to me and those of us who make it our own. We pay to play. Therefore, I believe we own this sport. I could go on and on and on, if I haven't already, that is. This sport is great and amazing. It is my religion. I feel so much for the bicycle. Greatness barely describes my feelings. Words are barely enough. Cycling makes my heart sing, even as it makes my legs burn. Those who dope are only hurting themselves, their teams, teammates, sponsors, organizers, families, friends, and bank accounts. And it's truly unfortunate for them. But they cannot hurt my sport. You know what, Sean? I think that that's a really, really great sentiment. And I think it's one of the things that we've all sort of ignored or turned a blind eye to in this whole Floyd Landis doping situation and the whole Operacion Puerto situation. Yes, we're fans of a professional sport, professional cycling or the Pro Tour, but we're also participants in a very different sport, and that's the cycling that each of us does every day in our own hometowns on our own bikes. They're similar in the same way that my driving on the freeway is similar to AJ Foyt out there in the Indy 500. We're both driving cars. Our cars are different. Our driving styles are different. And the reason for being behind the wheel is different. And it's the same thing as my similarity to Floyd Landis or Lance Armstrong or Jan Ulrich or anyone else, Tyler Hamilton, you name it. Yes, one of the differences is that I can buy the exact same bike that they're using and all the same components that they're using. But what I do on my bike, I do differently and I do for different reasons than they ride. And I think that you're absolutely right. That's my sport. My sport has not been hurt. But unfortunately, as you said, you and I and all of us Fredcast listeners are associated with the dopers. And that's the unfortunate thing. And that's why, unfortunately, time after time, I've got to mention it here on the Fredcast, because these are the things, these are the facts that we need to know about in order to counter those who really know nothing about either sport, professional or the one that you and I participate in. And we need to be able to be armed with that information so that we can inform those who are uninformed. So Sean, thanks so much for your email and for everyone's emails on this subject. It's very much appreciated. Now, this is the point in the show where I usually talk to you about an upcoming ride or two. And this time I've got one ride to tell you about. And I'm going to do it in the words of listener Marvin, who sent along an email to tell me about a century that he's getting ready to do. And just so you know, the word that I'm about to use is not a bad word, so I want to keep my family-friendly language, and I want to keep my clean tag on iTunes. This century is called the Big Dam Bridge Century, and that's D-A-M, as in a dam between a river and a lake. So don't get mad at me, folks. The Big Dam Bridge is the world's longest pedestrian and bicycle bridge, and it was built and designed specifically for that purpose. It's located over Murray, Lock, and Dam. And it's actually called the Pulaski County Pedestrian and Bicycle Bridge. It has a 14-foot wide deck that extends 3,463 feet across the Arkansas River. And it's actually a $12.5 million project that ties together 17 miles of scenic river trails in Little Rock and North Little Rock, Arkansas, and will eventually connect with 7,000 acres of various city, county, state, and federal parkland. Now, the bridge opens officially September 30th, 2006, and it's going to welcome walkers, runners, cyclists, and tourists. And this is the interesting part. One weekend each year, the bridge is going to be home to a 5K, both a run and a walk, and what they're calling the Big Dam Bridge 100-mile bicycle trek through central Arkansas that will celebrate the truly unique experience that is the Big Dam Bridge. Now, apparently, the platform is about 90 feet above the navigation channel, and they're saying that it should be just an amazing spot to catch what they're calling an invigorating sunrise or sunset over the Arkansas River. Sounds like a fun ride. Sounds like a really interesting place to visit. And the Big Dam Bridge Century is taking place September 30th, 2006. And I put a link in the show notes to bigdambridge.com. So thanks, Marvin, for sending that along. Now, next up, I received a voicemail on the listener hotline from listener Donna, and I wanted to play it for you right now.
Hello, Fredcast listeners. My name is Donna, and I'm not a Fred, but I'm married to one. His name is David, and he is a Fred. In fact, he's the host of this show. I want to send a shout-out to the Fredcast listeners and thank you for your support of the MS-150 Beta Bay Bike Tour and David's participation in it. Your support, your donations, and your emails mean a great deal to me, but I know that your support is especially important to David. I want to thank listeners Ward, Vincent, Ken, John, Robert, Carlton, Michael, and Simon, all of whom have generously donated to the National MS Society in honor of David and the Fredcast. As you know, David does have a day job. He has a family, he trains on his bike nearly every night, and he still somehow finds time to help plan the MS-150 and to do the Fredcast each week. David is passionate about the Fredcast, and he is so happy that it means so much to all of you. He's also passionate about the MS-150 and finding a cure for MS. So thank you again for your support. If you haven't already donated, there's still time, so please click on the link at thefredcast.com. David and I both appreciate it very much. Now, back to David and the Fredcast. Enjoy this week's episode, but most of all, enjoy the ride.
Oh, what do you know? Listener Donna is actually my wife, Donna. Anyway, thanks, Donna, for calling in. I'm actually halfway across the country once again, so the only way that she could record that was by sending it into the listener hotline. So, just a reminder, if you don't know what we're talking about, I talked about this last week on show number 32, and I asked for your support for my participation in the Land Rover Miramar MS-150 Beta Bay Bike Tour, which is taking place October 7th through the 8th to help find a cure for multiple sclerosis. And that's something that I deal with every day in my life because Donna, who you just heard, who's my wife, does have multiple sclerosis, and we are desperately looking for a cure for the disease. I really do appreciate all those listeners that Donna mentioned for very generously donating to the cause. And if any of the rest of you are interested in making a tax-deductible donation, I would greatly appreciate it. There's a link in the show notes. And of course, I've also put a link on thefredcast.com. It is right at the top left-hand side of the page, and I'd appreciate it. So thank you so much for doing that. Well, that's going to do it for this week's episode of the Fredcast. Thank you very much for listening, and thank you also for staying subscribed. Of course, I also appreciate it when you spread the word. Please, this week, tell three or four of your friends about the Fredcast, and go to Podcast Alley and vote for the Fredcast. There's a link in the show notes, and of course, there's also a link on the webpage where all you have to do is put in your email address and click vote, and then verify your vote with the email that you get back from Podcast Alley. I appreciate that. Lots of ways that you can stay in touch with us. You can do what Donna did. You can call our voicemail line. That's at area code 206-203-FRED. You can send an email with either your text comment or your audio comment to thefredcast@gmail.com. You can send audio comments in email or use the audio button like listener Lowell did. And that's on the webpage on the left-hand side under Contact Us. Of course, visit the website at www.thefredcast.com or go online to the Fredcast forums where you can interact with other Fredcast listeners between shows. And tonight we're going to end the show as we always do with PodSafe cycling music. Our music comes to us from the PodSafe Music Network at music.podshow.com. Tonight's song is called Irony. It's by a band called Farewell June. Links are in the show notes to their site on the PodShow website as well as to their own website. So until next week, I want to thank you all for listening. Thank you for staying subscribed. Be back next week with more Vuelta news, as well as news on the upcoming UCI World Championships. Until then, enjoy the music, but most of all, enjoy the ride.
Sarah was a friend of mine when I was in the 12th grade. She taught me things about life and human masquerades. She lied to her friends and to her whole family about the things that she had, what she wanted to be. She found out the hard way life's not easy when you're trying to be yourself, when you're living like somebody else. And life is irony, it's nothing like she thought it would be. The pain increases. She found herself picking up all the pieces, blindly walking down a center line highway as she talks with herself. When the words she could not say,
when the words she could never say.
To extend a helping hand, she turned her back in disregard. She fooled herself into thinking she was living the good life, but she was sleeping on a bench on Sunset Boulevard. And life is irony, it's nothing like she thought it would be. What made you think that you could do it on your own? Blaming your family, disgracing your home.